This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. My guest today is Thomas Chatterton Williams, whose new memoir is Self-Portrait in Black and White. This is one of the most memorable books I've read, not just in 2019, but in many years. In a world that's increasingly embracing identity politics that sorts people along immutable racial lines, Chatterton Williams is moving in a radically different and better direction. His book is an explicit call to unlearn race and embrace individual human diversity instead. The 38-year-old Chatterton Williams is the author of a previous memoir called Losing My Cool. He's mixed race himself and grew up in New Jersey identifying as black. He's married to a white French woman, lives in Paris, and describes how the birth of his first child, a blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl, forced him to interrogate and ultimately discard ideas about identity that he and the rest of us have long taken for granted. Here's a passage. "I'd become an ex-black man, not because I'd cease loving what I'd been taught to call black or because I wish my daughter to blend in with what I'd been taught to call white, but simply because these categories cannot adequately capture either of us, or anyone else for that matter. I had no guilt about it anymore because blackness like whiteness isn't real." In a wide-ranging discussion, Chatterton Williams and I talk about race relations in 21st century America, how class and gender intersect with ethnicity, and whether it's really possible to unlearn race in a country that has spent so much time and energy defining national character along racial lines. Thomas Chatterton Williams, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the elevator pitch for your book.
Sure. Self-Portrait in Black and White, Unlearning Race is, I would say, a first-person essay against race. It's part memoir, part argument, based on my experience of growing up a mixed-race black person, black father from the segregated South, who's old enough to be my grandfather. He's 82 this year.
And you are 38?
I'm 38. Okay. Yeah, my dad really grew up in an era prior to civil rights and had a very different American experience than I did.
And he grew up in Galveston, Texas, right?
Yeah, south he was born in Longview, grew up in Galveston. It's an island in the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah.
And it's kind of, I mean, it's Texan, but it's really kind of the old South at the same time.
Yeah, it was the last place in the United States to free its slaves 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah, that's like the Juneteenth.
Exactly, that's where Juneteenth comes from.
Right.
And in many ways, it was a kind of backwards place. And my dad realized very early on, if he wanted to have a chance at life, he had to get himself out of the South. Mm-hmm. So he moved west, eventually ended up in San Diego, where he was running anti-poverty programs under Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, and met my mother, who's 9 years his junior, the daughter of white evangelical Protestants. Her father was a Baptist minister.
And if I may, this is also, though, so this is Southern California and San Diego, when it was probably much more conservative than we identify Southern California with
and much
anymore.
Less ethnically diverse.
Yeah, there were no Mexicans.
There were none. Now where she's California, from, it's mostly Mexican and Filipino, but at the time it was not at all. It
right,
was
this is the post-war rural. Kind of boom exactly. And everybody moving there and, whiter than sheets or
exactly.
Something like that.
But she was working for the war on poverty too, and she really fell in love with my dad. And I don't know how some people are like this. My mother, I don't think, has ever had a racist thought. And so anyway, their relationship proceeded. But my mother's father, not my maternal grandmother, but my mother's father was really one of the majority of Americans who thought there was something morally wrong about a black person and a white person married.
I mean, in the book, it's in a very understated ways, but incredibly moving. I mean, like, he wouldn't visit your family.
Not at all.
And when you visited at one point out there with a Jewish friend, he like passed the guy the New Testament.
When
was
I
like,
came hey, after yeah. graduating college, he slipped my college best friend a copy of the New Testament on the way out and said, please
it
consider
this. It is good
this.
News. It is the good news. But yeah, that's kind of a dick move.
I thought it was. I was pretty mortified. And it was the moment where I saw that he would never be able to transcend his way of seeing his own life and attributes as normative and everyone else is a deviation from that. And I realized he would have tried to slip my dad a book to convert him from his blackness if he could.
But that, and I realize we're already in a digression here, but like, is that kind of a wonderful way to be, like where you are so firm in your worldview that like, It must make things less complicated on some level.
I think it does make things a lot less complicated. I don't think he was riddled with doubt.
Yeah.
Until on his deathbed, when I think he actually, my brother told me this after the book was in galleys, so I didn't have a chance to put it in the book. But my brother tells me that when he was dying, I didn't go to visit him, but my brother did. He said to him that on your deathbed, you realize that some things really don't matter, and skin would be one of those things, and that he enormously regretted losing his relationship with his daughter and not knowing his grandchildren, that it's a really kind of terrible thing to realize as you're dying.
Yeah.
That's what he told my brother.
Wow.
So I guess better late than never.
So you grew up and you have a previous a memoir that's really about how your father kind of transformed your life through his love of reading and kind of.
That's right. Yeah.
But you identified as Black, even though you're mixed race.
Yeah. So growing up in the 80s and mostly the 90s, in a kind of very segregated, informally segregated suburban New Jersey town. We lived on the white side of town. There was one other Black family, and my parents did this kind of as a protest against the racist real estate agents that wanted to steer us over the red lines. Growing up in this neighborhood, we were not white, my brother and me, and white kids didn't think we were white, and Black kids accepted us as Black. And in my parents' household,
they did or did not?
Did, yeah. Okay. Oh, absolutely. And in my parents' household, I mean, my parents are both sociologists, and they were telling us from the moment we were old enough to understand them that there's no such thing as being half white, and a drop of Black blood socially renders someone Black in this racist society. I don't think my father believes in the reality of race, but he believes in its social reality. And so it was not a complicated subject. We didn't, we said, okay, we're Black. We have a white mom. I didn't really think about that absurdity until the point that I was 30 years old, living in Paris, married to a French woman who, it never really struck me.
A white French woman.
White French woman. Very white. Yeah. It never really struck me. But she, you know, she has blonde hair and blue eyes as my mother does. Right. But I never thought of things that way. I just had a mom.
You know, this is not a Freudian podcast. This is a libertarian podcast. So let's get back to the,
But so when I had a blonde haired, blue eyed, white skinned child, 2013 in Paris, is when my kind of, I guess I would say that the fiction of race was thrust into my consciousness in a real way for the first time, in a way that it hadn't been in my own mixed race family growing up. I the categories fell apart for me.
And it's also, adding not simply being in a, you know, I hate to, and I feel like a dick using these terms like interracial marriage or something like that, but beyond being in a relationship with a white French woman, also being Black or African American, let's say, in France is a different experience than being African American in
America. Oh, really
America,
different.
Right?
Really different. And I would say that actually, like, race started to recede as the primary factor of identity in my life. And it was really nationality that became important. I was American. And like, what people thought of what my physical characteristics meant a lot less than that I spoke English, that I'm American, that I'm from New York. These were the things that...
And you, in the book, you mentioned in passing that sometimes you're mistaken for being Arab, which worse in France. I mean, it's a weird thing. Like, if you're a Black American in France, you're kind of liberated. If you're a North African Arab in Paris, that's a little bit dicier, right?
Well, you can run into some prejudice. I mean, mostly it happens to me at the airport. I just, on my way here on Sunday, I had a harder time than Black and white passengers, clearly Black white passengers coming off the plane, because Black people don't get stopped in airports and white people don't, but like ambiguously brown people do. So I had one of those annoying times when I'm read as something I'm not. But in my day-to-day life, I mean, as soon as I open my mouth, I'm American, and that's kind of a wonderful thing to be in Europe. I try not to make it seem at all as though I'm saying that France is a somehow more enlightened society that doesn't have racism, but the way that their prejudice and racism works doesn't really ensnare me.
Right.
I'm outside of they don't have the history of chattel slavery within their national borders. They don't obsess over a drop of blood. These things don't really come into my life out there.
And do they participate a little bit, though, in a kind of old school primitivism related to African Americans, or, you know, idea that Blacks are more in touch with authenticity and with...
They can get into a kind of Norman Mailer white Negro love of Black music and things like that. But I mean, the French kind of love Black music in a way that's, I think, ultimately to the good. And I think that the French also are so deeply anti-American that they like to be superior to the kind of debased white American racist who can't even appreciate this good music.
You know? Right.
they like to feel superior to that type of
boorish
white.
But then they try to dance to they love like to jazz dance. Or rock
they
and
love
roll,
to dance.
And it's a little bit, it's a little bit off-putting, to be quite honest. Your work really begins with the recognition that we're increasingly, in American society and globally, we're increasingly multiracial, multi-ethnic, and kind of nobody wants to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this so much. I mean, I get really the pushback I get that I'm most aware of is from the left. People on the left who really don't want to let go of these categories and say that we're not at liberty to, but also it seems more than just that they feel we're not at liberty to let go of these categories. They seem to not want to either.
Yeah. So talk a bit about that. And when you say the left, do you mean the...
I don't mean like, I consider myself a liberal. I mean like the far...
Progressives.
Left wing.
But I also mean, do you mean white people?
I mean,
or do you mean ethnic? And this is to the point of your book, none of what you're talking about is like, this stuff doesn't matter. It doesn't exist as a social fact, but you're saying, you know, like, what does blackness and whiteness, these are categories that are obviously always being constructed and deconstructed and reconstructed. But, I feel tongue-tied saying like, you know, ethnic or racial or whatever. But one of the interesting things is that white liberals, if you look at polls by Gallup and whatnot, they say that white liberals will say that racism is a bigger problem now in America than blacks do.
That's true. And they will also have a less favorable view of other white people than blacks and Latinos have of white people.
Yeah. So when you say, you know, people on the left don't want to give up these categories, is that mostly white people or is it also people who are African-American or Latino or...
In my real life where I meet actual quote unquote black people at readings or at universities I talk to, these people can be very open to the idea of getting rid of the pernicious categories of race that afflict us all. Extremely online, there's a kind of extremely online black person on Twitter that can get very angry about this conversation and feel like it's almost treasonous.
And then
there's a kind of white liberal as well, or beyond liberal. I don't want to categorize too broadly, but I get a lot of pushback from a certain kind of black, online black person.
So
personality.
What's going on? What's going on that, certain people, and we'll talk about this too, because one of the things that's fascinating about your work is you talk about how some of that attitude kind of mirrors or is in sync with an actual alt-right or white supremacist mindset that also doesn't want to let these categories go. But why would, why would left-wing or progressive people want to maintain categories at a moment when there are many reasons to believe we're finally getting rid of these categories, which everybody agrees have been, you know, horrible stumbling blocks and obstacles and divisive and just awful?
There's a few things that I've encountered. One is, it's just a mistake, but I believe it's earnestly believed. One is the idea that if you're denying that race exists, you're somehow also denying the reality of racism.
Mm-hmm.
I go to great lengths in the book to try to explain that that's absolutely not what I'm intending to do. You can have racism outside of the existence of race, and that racism actually creates race. And so that I don't see how you can adhere to categories that are produced by racism without having those categories necessarily imply certain hierarchies, value judgments, and things like of this nature. So you have that kind of person that resists because they believe that the one means the other. Denying race or rejecting race means that you're not willing to reckon with racism. Then there's another kind of person that I suspect the thinking would be, we're getting more out of these identities than we used to. It's working. We have some consensus here. There's an enormous discussion around white privilege and there's a kind of atonement on the left. There's a kind of mobilization around identity groups. Identity politics is persuasive and powerful. Like, why would I give up this group identity when, I don't think this is some affliction. This is working, you know?
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of pushback coming from that as well. Like on a pragmatic level, why would I stop being black?
So is that, I've heard some people
or not just black, because I wanted to emphasize, I'm not just talking about a certain type of critic keeps saying I'm only talking about black. I'm talking about race. So I would say that there's a kind of Latino who doesn't want to give up Latino-ness. There's lots of different identities that don't want to give it up because these identities, there's a power in a victim identity or in a historically oppressed group identity.
For the same reason, as people who listen to this regularly know and are sick of hearing, my grandparents on my father's side were Irish. My grandparents on my mother's side were Italian immigrants to the U.S. you know, certainly the Irish, to a certain degree, the Italians also want to still claim, you know, we were victimized, or, you know, no Irish need apply in like 1880 somehow, you know, that
still obtains. Yeah. I mean, there's still, I mean, Donald Trump rode into the White House on a victim narrative. I mean, there is great power from claiming that you're victimized.
I mean, and it's like, you know, that's a real put down, but I guess going back to, you know, the Great Society, or maybe a little bit before and a little bit after, but when things like affirmative action plans were put into place, I mean, they created institutional kind of power bases, you know, in places like higher education and big universities. And then if the historical discrimination, like the crassest form, the most obvious forms of that, have mostly been remediated, that power structure is still there. And is that what people are using to kind of maintain, you were saying, you know, certain pragmatic relationships?
Where, oh, I think affirmative action is, I wasn't even thinking of that. I mean, I'm thinking of like, you get a seat at the table, you get heard, you get deferred to. There's a kind of deference that comes now. You need to, you can maybe be an ally, but you need to be silent. I have the floor now to speak. That's a kind of intoxicating power to have.
Was on display at the Women's March, speaking of Donald Trump, the second iteration of that, the second year where the group, it became like white, you know, white middle class or upper middle class feminists, you know, just shut the fuck up already.
That's
you
mandatory. Know, that's mandatory.
Enemy. Yeah. What are the signs? You say, you know, okay, race, we need to kind of confront that and kind of move past or have a different conversation. Racism exists. What are the elements of racism or systemic discrimination or problems, bad power relations that persist?
I don't know that I made enough of a point about this in the book, but in interviews, I've been trying to be clear about this. I think that like reparations would be helpful. Something I think that you have real... I think that intergenerational wealth discrepancies rooted in historical oppression, even going way after slavery, you know, just within my father's lifetime, people of this generation who were disqualified from getting mortgages, or my father was in graduate school like all of his white classmates were, but he couldn't get a deferment from the military. And so he lost years of work by being drafted, even though others in his situation were. I mean, there are many ways which the country mistreated people based on the racial category they were thrust into. And I think that some form of reparations could, people being made more whole could go a long way towards alleviating some of this stuff. And then I think that, you know, you do have structural inequalities based on histories of oppression. I certainly don't mean to be glib about that or downplay the reality of how race has worked in this society.
You know, you cite people like Glenn Laurie and John McWhorter, among others, in your book, Self-Portrait in Black and White. And I think they would tend to argue that racism or discrimination is at a lower level, operates at a lower level now. I mean, a less potent level.
I know for a fact that I have not lived in the same country that my father has lived in. Mm. And I don't mean France. I mean America.
Right.
You know?
And even, I mean, at the same time you're growing up in New Jersey, he's living in a very different New Jersey than you are.
Yeah. I mean, I think that if you go through certain experiences, you can't ever fully transcend them, or maybe you can transcend them. If you've been through certain racist experiences, it's difficult to, sometimes it can be easier to believe that the country will never change than to believe that it changes slowly and imperfectly. Mm-hmm. But I think that actually my father would very much agree that we have lived in two different countries.
Yeah.
I think he kind of marvels at some of the opportunities that I've been able to have, and, you know, things of this nature, or a lack of friction. And I don't mean to say that that's all Black people's experience, but I do mean that he was an adult before it was legal nationwide to intermarry, before it was feasible for Black people to vote in parts of the South, before he didn't have to use a separate water fountain. I mean, I think he was like 27 before.
It's stunning. And it's, you know, you mentioned in the book when your parents got married in the late 60s.
They got together in the late 60s and got married in the early 70s. But, I mean, it had just become legal.
Yeah. And it's, you know, for me, the really stunning fact is if you go back and look at Gallup's surveys and whatnot, it was only in the mid 80s that a majority of Americans said that it was moral
to
marry. And it's like, are you fucking kidding? I mean, now it's like in the 90% range, but it's still like, how did it take so long?
Yeah, it's really something. You know, I mean, when they got married, 72% of Americans said it was absolutely wrong.
Yeah, which is, it's staggering. So growing up in the 80s and 90s, you, at one point in a kind of a throwaway line, you talk about how, like, you weren't really focused, or people, America wasn't focused on racial identities the way they are now, or the discussion was different.
The discussion was very different. Yeah.
And it seems, you know, there was that moment when in 2000, the U.S. Census, I think for the first time, had a multiracial, or rather an other category, so that you could be multiple races. They started rolling that out, or talking about it, in the late 90s. And Tiger Woods was kind of like the spirit animal of a new America. He called himself a Kablan Asian because he was Caucasian, Black, Indian, Asian Indian, as well as Native American. You know,
there's
so
a lot
created
going
this
on.
Portmanteau yeah. word for, and he said, you know, and I can remember, I wrote a bit about this. Maxine Waters, the African-American congresswoman from LA, said she didn't like way he was talking about it, because
a lot of people did. I mean, I didn't like that at the time either.
But what was going on in kind of that period in America, where it seemed like everybody was willing, willing and able to get past race and, you know, these kind of hardcore racial ethnic identities?
Well, I'm not sure if everyone was willing or able to, but I think that there was some form of hope. I mean, there was some form of optimism, certainly going into the first term of Barack Obama. There was a moment where people did actually speak unironically about a post-racial future.
Right. Yeah.
And then it quickly turned into, like, you're a fool if you even say that word.
So this is a weird and kind of bitter irony. And I know some people would say it's a predictable eventuality, but, you know, you get a Black president. And, you know, who, of course, is actually multiracial, right?
He's like, who he has was a performing mother, a Black yeah, American identity.
Absolutely. And, identified.
And getting it residually by being married to a Black American yeah. woman. But who Black writers like Stanley yeah. Crouch, when he first declared his candidacy, argued in op-eds and things, made the case that he is not Black. That was, right. Hillary Clinton had the majority of Black support, and Barack Obama was considered an interloper.
Right. And he was kind of like the Urkel candidate, right? He was,
but he was considered not authentically Black
right,
by Black writers.
Yeah, why
like
would
Stanley
he? I mean, he grew up in Hawaii. Like, he's the only yeah. Black guy in Hawaii.
And he was raised by a white family yeah. in a place like Hawaii and outside of America. And
right.
his father was an absent African immigrant.
Yeah.
I mean,
no,
that was hard
yeah.
for Black people to accept
but
at first.
Why do you think kind of the optimism, and maybe this was, I know writing in the 90s and I guess through the early 2000s, I thought a lot about how American culture, for a variety of reasons, was becoming more individualized, more personalized. You know, in our commercial lives and our work lives, everything was becoming, you know, like you could get monogram stuff easier. You could get personal, you know, playlists from Amazon, et cetera. You know, everything was more and more geared to specific individuals rather than large demographic groups. And it seemed that racial and ethnic identity was kind of like that we were all into this thing where we're, you know, we all are special and unique in our own ways. And that's an
we can all have a
vision.
Different colored iMac.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, or something else altogether. And, you know, you get to a point with Barack Obama where I think, and this is something where even the people who disagreed with his politics were, I think in a good faith effort, were saying, you know, like, this is kind of great. Like,
they were.
We
that,
can lay
in
to
the first,
rest.
First term, yeah. they were.
So what happened that we are now in a conversation which is probably, you know, as heated and as polarizing as has been in the past 50 years about
so it? I've seen this in my own family. I have extended family members on my maternal side who are Trump voters who I don't know if they can even admit it fully to themselves because they believe they're not racist because they like my dad and they like my brother. I think they don't like
they don't like me.
They think I'm an extreme left woke snob who writes for the failing New York Times. They have no idea that there's another conversation on Twitter that says that I'm a conservative.
That's
they would
right.
be shocked.
Yeah. They you know they might find themselves at the same anti rally against you. So with Richard Spencer on the one hand
right.
and Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, leading the other brigade.
So they think that they're not racist. So I don't think that they would be able to admit why it so disturbed them having Barack Obama as president. But I think that they're part of this large demographic of white Americans that was like viscerally triggered by his presence, and there's some form of racism going on with that led to a backlash. There's that for sure. I think on the left, there's also there was a profound disappointment that, hey, he's here. And actually, like, the world is still going on kind of as it has. Trayvon Martin got shot. A string of people tragically got shot.
Ferguson.
Michael Brown. Yeah. Lots of things happened. It was all caught on video. We all had these handheld cameras to disseminate video footage now. Just the other thing is, I think that we started talking about things that were much less extraordinary than getting shot. We started talking about microaggressions and started talking about, like, the small slights that I think it does actually require a lot of progress and a certain degree of comfort to start to be able to focus on.
Well, before we go to microaggressions too, one of the, you know, apart from kind of police brutality, which, it, you know, is when you're
very
saying,
serious, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and also, like, it's more represented now because of cell phones and things like that.
Yeah, I'm sure that a lot of things happened that were not captured.
Right. And it may be, Reason has covered kind of police brutality for, you know, 50 years, I mean, our entire existence. And Radley Balco, who used to work for us and is now at the Washington Post, has covered this extensively in the militarization of police. And he pretty much will argue that police brutality is probably at its low ebb now because police are more professionalized, but it's more visible because we can see it. So it's this, we may be in this odd moment where we are getting outraged, and rightly outraged, at these horrible acts, often very racist in, you know, in intent and follow through, even as they're becoming rarer and rarer. But that's out there for sure, which is pissing people off. But then something like Ferguson unmasked this whole kind of peonage system of where,
right,
it's like, you know, you're getting a fine, you get pulled over for a ticket, and then you get a fine for not
a
paying
the
ticket,
etc. A town making its money off the backs of its poorest, most exploitable citizens.
Right.
Yeah.
And then that leads, I guess, to a question, not of microaggressions per se.
Well, that would not be a microaggression.
Yeah. Do you believe in the kind of concept of microaggressions, and are they real, and is that the final stage that we have to get through, or is that a way of perpetuating forever a kind of grievance culture that so we could never get beyond?
From my position, I think at some point you have to say, how much does this actually really hinder me, and how much does it matter to me? This is John McWhorter's point too. I mean, at some point you have to say, actually, like, I'm healthy and strong enough that this doesn't cripple me. I'm talking about microaggressions. I'm not talking about police brutality or things like this. In the book, I write about encountering is one form of the definition of a microaggression, an aspect of the environment I'm in signaling my group's inferiority. I encounter this bust of, like, a slave head in my wife's grandmother's living room. And when I first encountered it, I was, like, mad. I was asking my wife, like, how is it possible? And at some point I realized that I was kind of, like, forcing myself to be madder than I actually was. And it's not that I don't care about these things or that they don't matter, but actually I have a really good relationship with this woman. She's 90 years old. She's from an extremely different time in the world. I'm not going to sit her down and treat her as though we're in a graduate English seminar. And I'm also strong enough to survive, and it doesn't really hurt me. And I'm already living on equal terms in a variety of ways. Even in some ways, I'm doing better than equal. So at some point that just, you know, just runs off me, and it doesn't stick, and it doesn't affect my sense of who I am. My dignity doesn't feel like it's at stake. So I think at some point you have to, microaggressions, I don't get hung up on them. I mean, I really feel like my father it would be difficult for him to understand the emphasis on microaggressions when you come from a background of actual aggressions.
Of macro aggressions,
just aggression.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that also kind of runs along a lot of the discussion of race and ethnicity in your book is class. Going back to this idea of, you know, something happened in the second term of Barack Obama, say, you know, where things got harsher, where it looked like we were moving forward or closer towards a post-racial America. You know, is class there? Because Trump, you mentioned, you know, this started before Donald Trump, and Trump in many ways is the effect, not the cause of this, although he's clearly participates in a lot of racist discourse and kind of promulgates it or allows it to happen, encourages it. With your cousin, say, or your extended family, the white family, is it perhaps, are there economic options not doing that great, or they feel like they're not getting forward in the world? And then they start looking for scapegoats.
It's strange. They feel they are getting forward in the world. They're super self-satisfied. They're like decently compensated working class, not educated, no college education, but like decent paying welding job or something like this, you know, have like type of people that own a home in a neighborhood I wouldn't consider living in, but they're very proud that they own their home and have a jet ski.
Yeah.
Keep a nice, so clean, new car.
So what's their beef then?
So feel that like people like me or you probably also are getting over somehow, you know, not really working, not really invested in America, you know, kind of, distrust of people who are comfortable in cosmopolitan environments, distrust of too much education, full of conspiracy theories about how elites really operate, you know, even though I think that this is from the polling that was done, I think that this is actually much more who is supportive of Trump is like not the actual white poor, but like the people who are doing better than the white poor.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, households making $50,000 or less overwhelmingly voted for Hillary Clinton. I mean, he actually did better with kind of the middle class and in many ways the upper middle class.
And so this would be the type of family members that I have.
Yeah.
But deeply, deeply distrustful of expertise and education.
And then that shows up in...
People who live in California and the fires are lapping at their doorway and they say that, you know, periodically the globe has always warmed and has nothing to do with man-made emissions, you know.
And somehow it's blacks and Latinos getting special privileges or something.
Oh, very much a kind of feeling that... Black people play the race card. If the police are bothering you, it's because you probably were doing something. And blacks getting preferential treatment, getting a lot of Barack Obama being the least qualified president ever. You know, these are people that voted twice for George W. Bush.
Yeah.
You know, this is the worldview.
I think Trump has really reset that table in a lot of ways.
But they would say no. They would say he's a good businessman.
Right.
You know, like this kind of crazy, he knows more about the economy than Obama ever could. You know.
So the subtitle of your book is Unlearning Race. And at one point you write, after a conversation with one of your French in-laws, I guess, said, I'd become an ex-black man on that evening, not because I'd ceased loving what I'd thought to call black or because I now wish my daughter to blend into what I'd been taught to call white, but simply because these categories cannot adequately capture either of us or anyone else for that matter. I had no guilt about it anymore because blackness like whiteness isn't real. Can you tell what was the moment where you realized you went from being black to an ex-black man?
Sure. This was actually after a conversation in Berlin that I was having with conceptual artist and philosopher Adrian Piper.
You go into her history. It's like pretty phenomenal.
She's fascinating and she's brilliant. She had a retrospective at MoMA in 2018 and I profiled her for the New York Times Magazine and
failing New York Times.
The failing New York Times Magazine. And we emailed for several months and finally she trusted me enough to let me come to Berlin. And I was really interested in how in 2012 she, as an art gesture, but also kind of seriously, she publicly retired from being black. Mm-hmm. She retired from race.
Could you explain very quickly her
background? Her background's fascinating. Yeah. Both of her parents are technically black, but her father was light enough that he was given two birth certificates. The first one said he was white, and his mother took him back and insisted that, say, he's an octoroon, technically black, 1/8. He passed when he was in the military. Once he returned to civilian life, he had such a terrible experience in the military, witnessing so much racism through the eyes of a perceived white man that he never passed again. And he and his wife, who was a daughter of privileged Jamaican immigrants, lived a kind of upper middle class lifestyle in Harlem, raising their daughter, who was light enough that poorer black neighbors in Harlem called her pale face when she was walking to school. People didn't realize that she was black. And she kind of grew up, you know, she started early as a conceptual artist with like Saul Lewitt. And at first she was doing art where there was no racial component. So people assumed that she was a white girl. And then they would be very disappointed when they found out that she was black. And so then her art took on more of a racial critique. But at some point she retired from being black. I was fascinated by this. And we started having this conversation this night at dinner and I was saying, well, you know, I've got this daughter that most people in the world would never know that she had any black in her. And
you mentioned in the book that she, if you go to Sweden.
Yeah, we have friends in Sweden that we visit sometimes and she fits in more than one of our Swedish friends who happens to have brown hair. People don't know that she's a descendant of slaves, but she is. Anyway, I said that I worried sometimes that maybe she wouldn't have any guilt or feel indebted to this kind of struggle. And Piper just said, well, if she doesn't feel guilt, why would she need to? I found I couldn't answer that. And it was the first time someone ever said, well, why does she need to feel guilt? You know, she said she can know who she comes from. She can have respect for that. But if she doesn't actually have the pain of the struggle, why would you impose that? Isn't the point to get past the struggle?
Another great bit throughout the book is, I mean, you mentioned 23andMe, and it's, yeah, you know, that's kind of maps of different colors to show where you come from and all of that. And I think one of the ways we can get past race is when we start to see people who we think, you know, you think you're one thing and then you realize you're a bunch of different things or
and
whatever.
Then most people realize that they're more mixed than they had realized, right, when they do a little bit of genealogical or DNA research.
Yeah.
The idea that people are monoracial really doesn't hold.
How do you talk to your kids about this in a way that both gives them a sense of where they are? Because this is one of, if when you read kind of Black American literature, a lot of it is the idea that you go back a couple of generations, and this is particularly true of older writers, obviously, but you go back a couple generations and then the genealogy just ends.
Yep.
Because it's like there's a master involved, or you're coming from Africa,
there's
whatever.
There's just the abyss, the void. Yeah. Yeah.
Or you're African as opposed to, you know, being from a particular country, mm-hmm, a particular tribe. How do you talk with your kids about, you know, what makes them up or where they come from without kind of reinscribing, you know,
yeah,
either racial hierarchies or discrimination or anger, things like
well,
that?
Well, I try to give them, well, my son is too young. I try to give my daughter, who's 6 now and old enough that we can talk about some of these things, a very specific sense of who she is. So I don't try to talk in abstract color categories. She knows she's both French and American. She knows that her aunt, her mother's half-sister, is partially Jewish, even though we're not. She knows that there's a variety of identities in her family. She knows that she's descended through my father from Southern slaves. She knows what that means. She would call herself Métisse, which is mixed. She is skeptical at 6 years old about why I would be Black. She says I'm beige. She says that her maternal grandfather is pink because he drinks and he turns red. You know, she doesn't understand whiteness and Blackness, but she has a very specific sense of where people come from and ethnicity, which I think is actually quite healthy. She has a granular story of her family, you know? And that's one thing I try to do. I also try to make conversations around race not ever lead her to a position where she thinks only of Black people as victims. I don't want her to associate Blackness with something she feels sorry about, or, you know, I don't want her to see my side of the family as something unfortunate. And so I really try to emphasize all of the Black traditions, the Black culture, the ethnic specificities of Blackness that I love, that are wonderful, that are not necessarily about being oppressed. We listen to tons of Black music in the house, you know. Throwing out race or refusing to play the skin game, I don't think means that you have to turn your back on the cultural traditions and the communities and the ethnic aspects of identity that people do seem to really need.
Right. One of the other traditions that you're working in is as a African-American writer who is living in France. And at one point you cite Eldridge Cleaver, a couple of passages from Soul on Ice. And, you know, Eldridge Cleaver is a fascinating figure for all sorts of reasons, but
that's sure, for sure.
Yeah. In Soul on Ice, he really takes, and I'm probably stepping in it now, but he takes James Baldwin to the woodshed for a number of reasons.
It's one of the most vicious writer-on-writer attacks I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah. It's like fucked up beyond belief.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
really
and
homophobic.
Yeah. It's, and, you know, Cleaver, I mean, he pretty much, he lights a fire in every part of the house in Soul on Ice, right? But he accuses James Baldwin of two sins, one of being gay, but even more importantly, by leaving America and moving to France and being gay, he literally figures, or figuratively figures, James Baldwin, you know, getting fucked in the ass by Western culture, by
wanting
white
to
culture.
Have its baby.
Yeah.
Yeah. If he could.
Talk a little bit about what it's like to be a, you know, an African-American writer living in France, because Baldwin is not the only Black writer.
No, there's a great tradition.
Sure. You know, and Richard Wright, certainly, and a number of other Black performers.
Chester Himes,
so, yeah.
Just not famous GIs who really paved the way, who stayed after the wars because it was more convivial to be there.
What do you draw out of that tradition, or how does that factor into how you write about things?
Well, I think one of the things you realize is that race and identity and who's at the bottom of the hierarchy is made locally. And so I think, you know, Baldwin has written really movingly about arriving in France and realizing that someone else occupies the position that you occupied back home. And that in his day was the Algerian. It probably still is. And so it kind of, I think, can be a liberating realization to see that oppression is kind of a human phenomenon. It's not just a black, white American thing. And also to understand yourself as an American, because I think I wouldn't put myself in this category exactly, but a lot of Black Americans, if you're talking about Richard Wright, you're talking about James Baldwin, never fully felt themselves to be American until they left, because at home they were only Black. They were not allowed to be American. So this tradition is one of liberation. But, you know, I felt profoundly liberated just to step outside of the American racial binary and the obsession with race that really does obtain here, and to just like, I can go, if I weren't professionally engaging in it, I could go for weeks without being aware of racial identity in France, because I could go weeks without even seeing a police officer sometimes, you know? And if I do see a police officer, I know he's looking through me. I don't even register for this. Race doesn't permutate my consciousness in the same way. And so that is liberating, even though I don't think that I was so oppressed at home, but you just can see the way that America is obsessed with it more clearly from a distance.
Do you find the way your kind of exploration and analysis and deconstruction of kind of race or racial categories puts me in mind of books by Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man by James Weldon Johnson?
It's a really powerful book.
It's amazing. And Charles Chestnut's The House Behind the Cedars. And these are books about people who can pass. But then when you think of people like Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, where Blackness becomes a kind of marker, and I guess in Richard Wright as well, for an existential, universal feeling.
That's or, right.
You know, talk a little
for
bit
the
about
human
that.
Condition.
Yeah. Like how does your kind of deconstruction of Blackness and you know, really in a way being intersectional? I mean, you're saying that you have a lot of different identities that partly explain you, and together they kind of build up to a fuller picture. How is that playing out in your work? And are you positing that kind of your experience is or can be a way of universalizing basic human identity?
Well, I mean, Ellison and Albert Murray, these are very important writers for me. And, you know, they just felt that America is fundamentally a mongrel nation, that Black Americans are not African, that they are a truly modern people that was created by the collision of Europe and Africa through the slave trade and mixing a bit with Native American populations in this new land, and became a new people, a truly modern people. And what they called the Negro embodies all aspects of American identity. It tends to be, his European side tends to be white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant. He has the Native American in him often enough, and he has the African in him. He combines all of America's elements, and they believe that the pain and the struggle that the Negro went through was specific to certain circumstances here, but that this is the human pain and struggle that we all go through, and that the Negro was a kind of clarifying figure for the kind of chaos and improvisation and dignity, a blues dignity, you know, that comes out of making something out of bad odds, you know, but making something better than what you got. I mean, Albert Murray wrote about how that's, you know, that's The Sun Also Rises, that's Greek tragedy. I mean, that is the human condition.
You have a phenomenal essay about Albert Murray and the nation from what's
Yeah,
like
I think that's 2015 maybe,
or so, yeah.
Something like that. Murray is a huge figure. I would say he's even bigger for me than Ellison, even though they're really operating on the same wavelength.
And you don't want Ellison, for me, when you strip away the racial dimension, which is massive, obviously, he's the case study of writer's block.
Like, you don't want to end up with that type of writer's block. But if you had to, it wouldn't be bad if the thing that you did get out was Invisible Man.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. You know, you believe in the reality of race in the sense of like it has, you know, it's a sociological phenomenon, a historical phenomenon, and it matters, and we need to take care of it. You dispute the idea of racial essentialism.
Absolutely.
Okay. So What are the ways forward to unlearn race as a society? You've done it for yourself. What are kind of concrete steps, or what are the conversations that we need to have? What are the minds that we need to kind of project ourselves into to actually unlearn race?
So what I'm writing about is a kind of imaginative labor that I don't think that you can just stumble into a better world that you can't first project, that you can't first envision. You're not just going to end up in this better future. You have to see what it could be like, and then you have to kind of will it into existence. And
so this,
through
again,
discourse.
I mean, I'm hearing a huge amount of existentialism.
I think so.
I mean,
yeah.
This is Sartre in his version of The Flies, where the hero at a certain point just says, I'm getting rid of this infestation through a mental. But
need other people. You need, you need to convince people. You need to persuade people. So that's one thing. What I am talking about is imaginative. Race exists as a perceptive error. You don't see the thing in front of you. You see a stereotype, a myth. You see, I don't see you. I see I see a group that I'm thrusting on top of you. But then also, of course, people are always eager to point out, and I accept this. Race is also, if it's not essentially real or biologically real, it is a certain set of things that have happened to groups of people. And I think on a material level, I think that we would get to a better future sooner if we did have a serious conversation about reparations. If we did honestly try to make people whole. I talk about this all the time, like the place in America where I've seen race work the best, where I've seen the least friction, where I've seen people treat each other with respect and dignity and actually interact and share spaces, not just tolerate each other, but share spaces, Martha's Vineyard. And I thought to myself, why is that? I'm not a fool. It's because every damn person there, black or white, is a partner at a law firm or
right.
higher.
Yeah.
Or it's Ray Allen from the Boston Celtics.
And they
but
can all,
when everybody
they're
is,
all shitting on Alan Dershowitz, right?
they can all unite.
We need a common enemy.
You do need a common scapegoat. No, but truly, when everybody encounters each other more or less on equal terms, some of the racial division takes care of itself. The problem is we don't often encounter each other seriously. We don't really encounter each other. We live very segregated lives. And when we do encounter each other, a lot of white people don't encounter black people as equals.
Right.
And vice versa. If that could change, I think a lot of the racial essentialism that we cling to could be alleviated.
Well, I'm going to goad you, if you're not already doing it. I would love to read your thoughts on class more than.
I think that's where you always end up if you want to. I think Americans, we often are actually talking about class when we're talking about race. We don't really talk about class well in America. And we're talking about ethnicity and class, but we're making it race.
Yeah.
Not always, but oftentimes.
So one of the ways is to imagine ways forward, and then to actually think about policies or changes that could redress some historical wrongs. Will we ever get to a point where we, know, like, okay, you know what, we've pretty much settled the past, now let's move into the present or the future?
That's what I worry about. And this conversation comes, there are people on the right that say it's ludicrous to even consider reparations. I think that that's a racist dismissal out of hat. But there are people on the left that say we will never be made whole.
Right.
That's really problematic.
Well, so,
if it can never be made whole, then you're essentially saying that white people are superior to black people.
Yeah, I want to, possibly in a high literary form, replay those great scene in Richard Wright's Black Boy where he talks about how the white office workers would have black kids box each other for their pleasure and betting.
This is an Invisible Man. Yeah, the Battle Royale scene.
There's also in Black Boy as well, the Wright book. But I was going to say, you brought up reparations and people saying, we'll never be able to be made whole. You have a running feud with Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Well, it's not a feud because he doesn't engage. He comes down, pronounces,
He is kind of the premier voice for a black public intellectual, right?
Your
generation. What's your beef with him?
Well, I just think, he's an exciting writer, especially in his early days when he was searching and kind of curious. But I think he got some things, he oversimplified some things in Between the World and Me. I think that he has no way of describing a black reality like my own, which is not as rare as it may seem.
Would he say that you don't count as black?
I don't think he would, because he actually in the past has, a book that he blurbed and that seems to have made an impression on him is Racecraft by Barbara and Karen Fields. He has a kind of healthy skepticism towards the idea of race. And I don't think that he would reject the idea that if you have one black parent, you have an authentic claim to blackness in America. But I think that he has no way of explaining black realities that are outside of this kind of inner city experience that he had, that are not deprived, that are not set upon. I think that he doesn't explain a middle-class black reality. He has no way of explaining the enormous success he's had, mostly because of extremely enthusiastic white readers who have been very interested, the opposite of dismissing him, have been very interested to hear what he has to say. And I mean, I don't think that his analysis of how race works can justify or explain how fast his argument for reparations went from being considered ludicrous to being what every major Democratic candidate for president now says must take place. You know, right. He's had an enormous impact, largely because white people want to take seriously what he's saying. So I think it's not nearly as pessimistic as he would argue.
What will it take to get you to move back to America?
The right kind of job offer. Mm-hmm. I had one a couple of years ago, but it fell through. The magazine that I was coming back to work for was quickly shuttered because the editor was one of the, how do I say this? This will be edited. The editor was, I don't want to say that. It was some form of brought down in the Me Too era.
I see.
And the magazine disappeared. And so we didn't end up moving back.
Oh, okay. So is your wife going to write a book about this? You know, what's it like to, you know, be married to somebody who won't shut up about how we need to get past race?
No, I think my wife is really fascinated by this. And I think that from a European perspective, it surprised her at first that that a drop of black blood would make a child black, not because she thought the child should be white, but she just didn't understand the conversation around what we call hypodescent here. Yeah. She'd never heard of that before. It's like foreign to her European mind. But, you know, she understood it and she got on board with me because my position evolves. In 2012, before my wife got pregnant, I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times arguing that there was a kind of moral obligation to hold on to the one drop rule. And that I lost my faith in that logic, both by seeing how absurd it would be to send a child out into the world making these declarations that contradict the way they look and insisting on them, but also because, you know, I started to think more seriously about the plantation logic that informs that. But, you know, she's always been very interested to learn more about race and to kind of...
Especially in a way that deflects historical guilt from the French experience, I assume.
No, my wife is far more critical of the French probably than even I am.
Well, that's good to hear. The book is Self-Portrait in Black and White, Unlearning Race. The author is Thomas Chatterton Williams. I mean, you're optimistic about the future. And what is the world that you want for your kids and the kids that they're interacting with?
I'm terrified about the future when I think about climate. But in terms of the trajectory of our society, I think that the election that means more about who we are becoming and what we want to be is the election of Barack Obama, not the election of Donald Trump. I don't think the election of Donald Trump signifies a movement on the ascent. It's an unhealthy manifestation of something dying. I believe that. I could be wrong, certainly. But I think who we are becoming is the nation that wants to be the kind of place that elects Barack Obama, not Donald Trump.
All right, we'll leave it there. We've been talking with Thomas Chatterton Williams, the author most recently of Self-Portrait of Black and White, Unlearning Race. Thomas, thanks for talking.
Thanks for having me.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this show and Reason's other podcasts at reason.com/podcasts.